There is a disinformation program, literally, for everyone, no matter who you are and what your interests are, what your beliefs are, which way you're focusing. There is a website set up just for you to take you in and to vector your thinking and your attention into the way that they want you to think.
You are listening to Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of an occupied America.
Welcome to this week's Signs of the Times podcast. I'm Henry.
I'm Joe.
I'm Scott.
And we have with us this week our special guest, Jason Knight.
It's not like special ed, is it?
In any case, you're very welcome, Jason.
We know you're excited
to
be here.
I'm jumping for joy. No, I am. I am very excited to be here.
This week, we are going to be looking at sport, current affairs, and movies. Following this week's brouhaha over the headbutting incident with French football star Zidane at the World Cup against Italy last Sunday, we are going to be looking at some of the implications, political and otherwise, of this. Then we want to take a look at the crimes that are being committed in Palestine and Lebanon by Yahweh's stormtroopers. And we're going to finish up with a discussion of films that you must see if you want to understand our reality. So to begin, the topic of Zidane and the headbutt. We were all watching it here last week, and we were all rather stunned to see Zidane very, very effectively use his head as a weapon.
Well, you know, I kind of disagreed with the whole red card thing because, I mean, when you think about it, he was really kind of obeying the rules of soccer, you know, because he wasn't touching him with his hands. You know, he was using his head.
So I think it wasn't a foul. It was no handball.
There was no hands touching the ball. So I think that he was really, you know, keeping with the spirit of soccer by hitting him with his head.
Well, maybe we should recap a bit the incident for those people who are not aware of it. In the World Cup final between France and Italy, it went into overtime with a score of 1-1. And at the 110th minute, the Italian player Materazzi was knocked over in some way. And in the replays, you saw Materazzi and Zidane walking side by side with Zidane kind of pulling away. And you could see that Materazzi was saying something to Zidane. And at one point, Zidane turned around and lowered his head and delivered a swift blow to the chest that knocked Materazzi off his feet. And the speculation was, you know, why? The announcers on the French television were going, pourquoi, pourquoi, why? Why would he do something like this? This was Zidane's final football match. He's been a major star, not only in France, but the world over for several years. He was one of the principal stars of the French team when they won the World Cup in 1998 against Brazil. He had retired in 2004 and then came back to the French national team in 2005 after having some sort of a strange experience where in the middle of the night he heard a voice telling him that he should return to the French national team, which is a whole story in itself. The speculation started right after the match as to what Materazzi could have possibly said to Zidane, and several newspapers and news organizations hired lip readers to look closely at the videotape. We imagine that somebody must have an audio tape of what was actually said. In a media event such as that, it's hard to imagine that there wasn't somebody with a boom microphone of some sort that would be able to catch the exact words. The speculation was that Materazzi had been insulting Zidane's sister, insulting his mother, had called him a dirty Arab terrorist, and that finally Zidane had cracked. So then the question becomes, should he have done it? He's a major figure who many, many people look up to. Kids look up to him, and there he goes. Seems to go crazy on the pitch and take out another player. Laura wrote an editorial about this event early in the week, and it's become one of the more hotly debated subjects on the Signs of the Times forum, with people defending Zidane, people criticizing him.
Well, I think what you got to ask yourself is, what would you have done? You know, at a certain point, does somebody's verbal jibes become a little bit too much for you to take? And we also have to remember that Zidane was injured not too long before that. So, I mean, he was probably really tired and in pain, and, you know, Materazzi was riding him and, you know, insulting him. Apparently, one of the people claimed that Materazzi's exact words were, "You are the son of a terrorist whore." And, of course, on a French interview, he said, "Bon oui." You know, he said, "Of course." You know, that was what he had said. So,
well, although it's claimed that he, or Zidane has claimed in a recent interview on television that Materazzi didn't call him a terrorist, didn't use the word terrorist, but we kind of suspect that it was suggested to him, or he was put under some pressure.
PR wash.
Put under some pressure not to kind of increase tensions, because that would be a very quite a provocative thing for him to admit that Materazzi said to him. So
and FIFA, the World Football Association, has very explicit rules against racist.
Particularly,
you can insult other players, but just don't be racist.
Yeah,
about
but
it.
But I think it was very. It was potentially bigger than the normal kind of racist comments that are quite common in football, because of the implications. And this is what we've been, that Laura wrote about in her article, and this is what we've been discussing on our forum, is that there were kind of implications given the current political climate and what's going on in Israel, because obviously Zidane is Muslim, and there is a war on essentially Muslim terrorism going on, right. And Israel is conducting a war on
it's a war on Arabs,
well, you Muslim can, terrorists.
You can also add in the extra part of, you know, there was previously implications that his father fought for France in the Algerian independence wars. So, you know, and of course they were pretty much disproven completely, you know, but it was something that was probably, you know, weighed heavily on him to have his father accused of fighting for the other side by mm-hmm. his, you know, native people. So if Materazzi did in fact call him the son of a terrorist whore, then of course that's going to rub even deeper than just the fact of the current political climate.
And speaking of the current political climate, those of you who are not familiar with the problems in France at the moment, there have been a series of riots, which basically mostly poor and, to a large extent, Arab youth were rioting in various cities.
This was last November.
Yeah, because obviously that's the kind of point I'm trying to make as well, that this comment, if it was a racial comment made by Materazzi, which it seems to be, against Zidane, it was far more than the typical kind of comments that are heard by footballers, or exchange between footballers, or even between fans and footballers on the pitch all the time, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
because there are so many angles to it, and particularly at this point in time, it's a very sensitive subject. And as Scott mentioned, given the fact that there is a lot of tension in France with the 10 million French citizens who are of largely Algerian or African parentage, there's a lot of friction there. Because they, as Scott mentioned, they live in, they're largely in, living in poorer areas of France, and it just for me, the whole thing was problematic from the point of view of the authorities, and that this is why I think that Zidane was probably told not to say or to deny that the terrorist word was used against him, when in fact it was, and just to make the point, and this is the point, I just want to stress this point, because this is the point that we're trying to make on our forum, and a lot of people don't seem to be getting it, is that there are, strangely enough, there seems to be a very clear parallel that can be made between what happened on that pitch and what is happening in Israel and in the Middle East right now. Henry, you were discussing or talking earlier on about something that Zidane said just recently in another interview over the issue.
Yeah, last night he appeared on two French television stations to kind of explain the incident. And in one of them, he made the comment, "My action was inexcusable." And then he continued, "But the real guilty need to be sanctioned because the guilty party is the one who provokes."
Yeah, so I mean that, I mean, you could say that very, very easily.
Does
about,
that describe what's going on?
Yeah, about the Middle East, about the fact that Hamas and Lebanese Hezbollah and the Palestinians are all being provoked in the same way that Zidane was provoked on the pitch. And they're being provoked in essentially through the same kind of slur, which is the terrorist slur that all Muslims or all Arabs are terrorists.
Exactly.
And they are responding. They are obviously reacting because obviously it's much worse for them than it was for Zidane, but because their lives are being threatened by this provocation and this these attacks that Israel is committing against them. And it's being done under the aegis of the idea that they are Muslim terrorists, all of them. Therefore, the people in the West can't accept it. And the other parallel is the fact that Materazzi has a Star of David tattoo on his arm with Hebrew text. So, I mean, it is pretty
clear.
Talk
about symbolism.
It is pretty symbolic. You had a guy with a Star of David tattoo on his arm calling an Arab on the pitch a son of a terrorist whore, and provoking him to respond and attack or defend himself, and then the Muslim or the Arab getting condemned and sent off the pitch or slated for it. And that's exactly what's happening in the Middle East.
And this comes right after the whole Danish thing. You remember the cartoon with Muhammad, yeah. You know, and it was essentially the same kind of goading.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
From other people to get them to, and surprisingly, I think the reaction from the Arab population was less than what was expected. And then, because, I mean, you know, it's just generally not cool to be so coarse about somebody's, you know, religious icons. You know, sometimes we make fun of Christianity, but we are from Christian families, so we sort of have a, you know, a different right, you know, kind of a right, but we don't really go around doing that kind of stuff. It's kind of rude, you know, so you can, and that kind of thing at this time, you know, the friction that's already there, that it's like tossing a match into a room full of, you know, gunpowder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all this little stuff, you know, the headbutt against Materazzi. It's just, you know, it's just constant goading. It's this never ending pressure, this constant friction that they're applying to the Arab populations, that is just, you know, they're frantic. They're backed up against the wall and they're
responding, right?
They're responding, and what Zidane is saying when he's saying that the provoker is the one who's the real guilty party, then that's just really profound
it's
and true.
It's completely true, yeah. And but it's not represented in the media. I mean, that angle is never presented in the mainstream media.
One of the things that you hear, one of the criticisms of Zidane, and we should say that in a poll that was taken this week, 61% of the French people who responded said that they kind of supported Zidane. So I think this is significant. But what I wanted to bring up was, in a sense, the kind of psychopathic character of aspects of professional sports, where it is taken as being completely reasonable and part of the game that you can be insulted and provoked in this way when you're out trying to play.
Mm-hmm.
And this is accepted by everybody the world over as the way professional sports are played, and it is completely natural that you insult your opponent and you goad them in whatever way you can, that you are goaded and you're supposed to rise above this. And in a certain sense, what Zidane was saying, no, there is something more important than a sports match, than a football game,
mm-hmm.
even the World Cup, and that's human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying there is a limit over which I am not going to take it,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to stand up and say no.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been this very curious thing where there was this movement to idolize Zidane as the great kind of consummate sports hero. And when he got himself thrown out of the game, that all crumbled. And yet what you get then instead is the emergence of a hero just who is a human being who is willing to say no to the psychopathic environment in which he's living.
It's a perfect analogy. It's a perfect example of what we talk about on the science page and on the website in terms of psychopathy, because just imagine the scenario where you have a certain percentage of psychopaths, who are football, professional football players. And as psychopaths, they have no, essentially no emotion. They don't feel emotion. They don't feel human emotion, and they have no conscience.
They're willing to do anything to win.
Yeah, they can do anything.
They can do it.
But at the same time, you have people who have a capacity to feel human emotion and be hurt by comments or by slurs made against them. And I mean, who's going to win in that situation? You've got a bunch of psychopaths running around the pitch, calling, shouting out, you know, all sorts of things about people, other players' mothers and stuff. And when it's shouted at them, they go, hey, cool, you know, yeah, my mom is a terrorist, or, you know. Or they agree because they're essentially have no conscience, right, and no human emotion. But the people who do are the ones who are going to explode and can only take so much. Right. And then they're going to react, and they're the ones who get sent off. And it's a perfect example of the way it works in politics, the way it works in the judicial system, and it's a perfect example of what's going on in Israel at the moment as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, that analogy is basically like, you know, a person wearing a bulletproof vest and a person who isn't, you know, and shooting at each other. You know, of course, the person who is not going to feel it, you know, it's not going to hurt them.
So the point is that the system, even into football, is set up to ensure that psychopathic values win the day, that they are perpetuated. Because, you know, you see this even on our forum, as we're mentioning about the discussion, where people are saying, oh, you know, they're trying to justify this kind of these kind of attacks, these kind of comments and these racist and very, very evil comments that are made by footballers to each other, and they're saying, hey, it's just football. You know, you should be able to accept that, you know. Mm. And these are people who essentially have been corrupted. Their sense of conscience, their sense of morality has been corrupted by these psychopathic values, where you're told that when someone turns around and calls your mother a terrorist whore, that you should just accept it and get on with it, and you shouldn't respond.
It's part of the game.
These are the values that are being spread around, and these are the same values that are allowing a large number of people in Western Europe to sit back and watch what's going on in Palestine, in the Middle East, and complacently kind of say, well, they are terrorists after all, aren't they? So, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Americans, for the most part, live in a culture where, first of all, you know, you have this concept of capital punishment in America, you know, where a murderer gets murdered, you know, type of thing. So you can't help but being trained from a young age to, you know, start saying that people deserve what they get, and then all of a sudden it's very easy to say that about someone that you don't have to pull the switch. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that most of the Americans, most of the voting public, and most of even Europe, they're not really directly affected by that kind of conflict, so it's very easy for them to say, you know, it's not me, you know, it's like the zombie song from the Cranberries, it's not me, it's not my family. But with someone like Zizou, you know, he's Muslim, he comes from Algeria, you know, they had an independence war with France, you know, he's been through some tough times, you know, and he's sitting there getting ridden by Materazzi, and he reacts and he headbutts him. And
people don't realize the effect that all of the demonization of Muslims that has resulted from the 9/11 attacks, they don't realize the effect that has on ordinary Muslim people. I mean, people in the UK, people in France, people in Spain who are Muslims and who are obviously Muslims because of the way they dress are probably once or more than once every day, they're treated like terrorists. By someone.
Give it the
eye. And can you imagine living? I mean, it would be like being a black in South Africa.
in the United States.
Well, or no, but under an apartheid regime in South Africa, that kind of thing would seriously affect you after a while. And you can imagine that Zidane is very aware of that as part of – he may not be subjected to it.
But he grew up in one of those neighborhoods.
But he may not have been subjected to it in the same way as ordinary people since 9/11. But he certainly identifies with it because he describes himself as a non-practicing Muslim, and there's an identity there or an identification with his the Muslim people. Mm-hmm. So he's very aware of it, as all Muslims are. And for Materazzi to turn around and say this on the pitch, I mean, I can fully understand that it would have been the one thing he could have taken anything else. Right. But to use that, and it just brought all of the other stuff flooding
and
back.
To relate it to his mother, who had gone to hospital that day, mm-hmm. and who had been operated on not long before.
And these are people. These aren't Muslims. The U.S. government and the Israeli government is trying to separate humanity into groups and have one group of humanity, i.e. Christians in the West, essentially sanction the murder of another group of human beings. And the people who are doing this are the people who are not really human beings in terms of their ability to feel that human emotion and to empathize.
Yeah.
And people don't realize this. And we get people coming on our forum and they're essentially apologists for this kind of psychopathic thinking.
Right.
And they don't realize that it's us against them. It's the ordinary people against the psychopathic elite.
Right.
And but people are falling into the trap of allowing themselves to be divided and to essentially, I mean, you've got 130,000 U.S. Young U.S. troops in Iraq killing what are essentially just other ordinary human beings at the behest of a bunch of guys in government.
Right.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the topic of the apathy and of the people on the forum and the talk that Zizou shouldn't have reacted that way because of name-calling. You know, there's an old rhyme that every American learns as a child, and we sing it all the time, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. But that's ridiculous. You know, words do hurt. Words are very real things, you know?
Yeah.
And what Materazzi said, if that's what it said, and I believe that that's what he said. You know, I mean, I think that's a pretty reasonable assumption of what was said.
It would probably be the most logical thing for someone like Materazzi to say in the current climate.
Yeah,
would and of be course he denied it.
Yeah, of course he
denied it profusely.
But Materazzi is obviously a liar because Materazzi, in his defense, said that I would never say anything about Zidane. I would never say anything about Zidane because he's my hero.
Yeah,
and if yeah, I mean, you don't even have to hear what he said. All you have to do is watch what he did, which is he was grabbing and pulling and harassing Zidane. Is that what you do to your hero? The guy is obviously a liar, so we can say that with complete certainty. And from there.
Well, not only that, but also the fact that you have these various professional lip readers who had come forward and said, "Yes, this is what he said." And I mean, you don't get to be a professional lip reader if you have no idea what people are saying.
90% of the time, you know. So obviously, the person who they're talking about. But
So let's offer a salute to Zinedine Zidane for taking a stand.
Zizou.
For taking a stance for Jesus, for taking a stand, you know, because he did take a stand, and it's being promoted all around the world, and particularly in Western Europe and America, that you shouldn't take a stand, that you shouldn't, stand up for yourself or for values that you hold dear. That you should just kind of lie back and allow your mind and your sense of conscience to be corrupted.
And as we've been trying to do in this discussion, to tie it to what's going on in Palestine at the moment, this is exactly there. No one in the world is standing up and saying what is going on in Palestine, the genocide that Israel is committing on the Palestinians, is a crime. It is a horror. And it shouldn't happen. Yeah.
And no one's saying that.
Nobody's saying anything.
Because their conscience has been watered down to the point where they're useless. They can't even stand up and say something's wrong. You ask someone about what's going on in Palestine, they say, well, you know, they kind of are terrorists, aren't they? And it's like, who told you they were terrorists? Have you ever been there? Have you ever lived there? Do you know anything about the situation? No, but, you know, George Bush says they're terrorists.
And he says Israel has the right to defend itself.
Yeah, of course, yeah. All these kind of power moralisms, you know.
Well, I mean, that does kind of come down to the question is, do you have the right to kill people when you're defending yourself?
But Israel's not defending itself.
Right, right, right.
I mean, that's that.
It's doing,
do you
it's
have
doing,
the right to
doing
provoke?
Preemptive strike type stuff where it's saying that they're going to attack, so we're going to go in and attack first.
They're setting them up to be knocked down, basically, you know what I mean? But
you know, there's a lot of discussion of the rocket attacks that supposedly come out of the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
And these are homemade artisanal rockets that have killed 4 people. Israel kills more people every day than these rockets have killed in the last few years.
Yes, so they're obviously not a threat.
Israel is armed to the teeth by the United States. It has one of the most advanced armies in the world, and it is using full force
but Israel
against
is a victim.
The civilian. But Israel portrays itself as the victim. And what's been coming out this week is that they're now using a new arm on Palestinian civilians, civilian populations, that is tearing limbs off and it is burning the skin. And the Palestinian doctors have never seen anything like this. It is something that is impossible to treat.
Here's what I would ask any of our listeners to conduct a little test on themselves and to ask themselves a question or to think about their opinions. If they were asked about what's going on in Israel and Palestine and what's going on in Iraq, when you analyze your opinions, are they clear cut? Are you able to say yes, it's wrong, or is it? Do you have kind of it's not black and white. There's a gray area. Blah blah. If that's the case, then you have A, been denied the facts of what's happening, and or B, your mind has been corrupted and your own sense of conscience and your own humanity has been watered down by something. Because to hold an opinion about what's going on in Iraq or Palestine that is not 100% behind the victims, the very clear victims, means that you are not in touch with your humanity, your claimed humanity. Because let me give an example. Last night, I think, or Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, the Israeli Air Force dropped a 1/4-ton bomb on a residential apartment, two or three stories, and they killed a mother, a father, and 7 children.
And they said, we didn't know there was anybody in the building.
They said, but I mean,
it's just garbage.
Since when did people...
Well, I read a figure today, you know, what's going on for the last week or 10 days in Gaza is horrifying. But even before that, the week of the 6th to the 12th of June, this is before things started to get really, really out of hand. But that week, 79 Palestinians were killed.
Mm-hmm.
And 79 Palestinians, that's just in a regular, normal death by attrition, genocide by attrition week. 79 Palestinians murdered brutally by these savages.
And we see how the people in America, people in Europe, people around the world are completely, their responses, they're completely controlled by the mainstream media.
Completely.
Their responses, the mainstream media and the government can elicit a response in an individual person. That's how complete their control is. That because they haven't been playing up the stuff that Henry's just mentioned. If they did, they could play it up in such a way that everybody would be horrified. People would be feeling deep down this emotion. And it would be because of what the mainstream media said. But because they're not doing that, people aren't feeling it. They're just... They don't know what's happening, or they're getting an angle on it which suggests that Israel is a victim, so they can forget about the fact that 79 Palestinians were murdered. So it's just incredible how complete the control that the media has over individual people's lives, over what they think and what they do and what they feel. It's almost beyond belief.
Yeah.
So, I mean, talking about psychopathy, we talk about psychopathy a lot. And just to clarify for people what psychopathy is not some catchphrase that we use. just a coverall to any time anyone, anybody in power or anywhere does something wrong, we say, oh, it's psychopathy. Psychopathy is something that has been studied scientifically, and there are conclusive results from studies which show that there are people, human beings, a lot of them, who do not appear to possess a capacity to empathize with another human being. They do not have the normal range of emotions, if any emotions at all.
And this is a genetic difference.
Yes.
This is not simply because they've been raised in unfavorable circumstances or in a violent family.
No, this is people who were born that way, who grew up with exemplary parents and siblings and had a wonderful upbringing, and they exhibited this complete lack of empathy for another human being. Now, on that point, so it's accepted, and it's a fact that there are people on this planet, a lot of them, statistically, it's 1 in 25. About 4, 5, 6%, somewhere around 4, 5, 6% of the population, which is about 360 million people. Now, if anybody else can give me a better explanation of why or of how an Israeli general, the Israeli government, Ehud Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister, how a person like that can order the Israeli Air Force to go and drop a 1/4-ton bomb on what they surely knew was a residential accommodation with a family in it, and kill the mother and father and 7 children. To do that consciously, somebody explain to me, give me a better explanation than the scientific proof that there are people who do not and cannot empathize with another human being.
Then look at what has happened in the last few days in Lebanon, where Hezbollah captured 2 Israeli soldiers. The Israeli soldiers were in land that belonged to Lebanon that Israel captured and has been claiming now as their own. So this is effectively invaded Lebanese land. Hezbollah goes, captures 2 Israeli soldiers, and Israel declares war on the entire nation, and they're now bombing Beirut. They're telling the population in Beirut that they should evacuate.
They bombed the airport. They've established an air and sea embargo on Lebanon, which is a sovereign nation, slightly bigger than Israel. And Israel just, on the capture of 2 of their soldiers who were actually invading Lebanon and who, under completely normal and fair rules of war, would be captured.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they weren't just killed, but they were captured, Israel is now using this as justification to wholesale invade and embargo another country.
And the latest news that I saw, I haven't actually read the article, I just saw the headline before we started the podcast, was that Hezbollah, the rumor is that Hezbollah has taken these 2 Israeli soldiers, the prisoners that they took, they've been taken into Iran. That was on the Drudge report. So now,
so you can see what they're trying to do.
Oh yeah,
and they're trying to bring Iran, Syria. They've got Iran. They've got Lebanon.
All of this is such a massive, massive setup. Oops. All of it has been provoked. Is being provoked by Israel.
What's wrong?
Israel wants to start a major war in the Middle East so it can solve its Arab problem, i.e. its problem with about 3 or 4 million Palestinians in Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iran. This is Israel's plan, and it's right there in front of everyone's faces, and no one notices it. No one seems to get it, mainly because the mainstream media is completely owned by Israel and owned by the American government. And you can take that to the bank. Or you can put that in your pipe and smoke it.
One kind of strange thing is that, I mean, here's Israel, and of course, yes, they have all these weapons. I mean, they have F-16s.
Nuclear weapons.
Yeah, an estimated 200 nuclear weapons, although no one knows because they just say, well, we're not going to tell anyone, and everyone else says, oh, okay. And then, of course, when they attack someone, you know, you have all these countries, including several European countries, who just say, oh, you know, could you just exercise a little bit of restraint, Israel? Because, you know, we, you know, not to, you know, I mean, don't get mad at us, but, you know, you're kind of slaughtering people and, you know, bombing airports and stuff. You know.
Could you kind of
just could you
ease
maybe
off a little?
Just drop, yeah, like one fewer bomb maybe or something, you know, just to kind of make everybody
talk
happy.
Talk about spinelessness.
We're trying to control the media, but if you really go overboard, it may leak out, and that would be really bad.
I mean, the American government is long past anything other than, you know, all of them should be heading for the gallows. So, as we speak, but I mean, some people might have thought that the European Union or European country leaders or European leaders of European countries or the UN would say something or do something practical, do something that really made a difference or really put some pressure on to stop it. And they're just a bunch of spineless, yellow-bellied, low-down snakes. And I'd like to add that that applies also to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, and most other Arab countries who have all sold out 100% to their own people and are going to burn in hell for it. Maybe.
Quite possible.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, and so you've got all these countries, you know, in the Middle East. And of course, you have a country like Iran, which is not exactly, you know, like this, you know, well, a toothless old Grishna cat, to use a Klingon expression.
Yes.
But and, you know, so, and of course, I mean, Israel has the backing of the United States at the moment. And so obviously Israel thinks that, well, they can just attack whoever they want because the you know, the U.S. will back them up and, you know, good old George Bush will come, you know, riding on his horse and, you know. But what happens if the U.S.'s support disappears? Or what happens if, you know, some little thing happens? I mean, it's going to be... There's going to be a counterattack, and there's not going to be an Israel left.
Well, I mean, Israel is violating, like, you know, just about every single one of Sun Tzu's, you know, rules of war. I mean, they're starting wars in other countries. They're going to end up they're occupying a territory and fighting a war with a foreign, you know, in another country they're invading. You know, and then they're going to, of course, automatically piss off all the allies of Lebanon, and there's someone else is going to join in. So they're going to make the basic, you know, Third Reich mistake of fighting a war on multiple fronts, which is like the worst mistake you can make, and they're just going to run themselves ragged. And
well, you know, it's been our kind of sneaking suspicion that at some stage, once this kind of Israeli-inspired or provoked Middle Eastern war really gets going and they start killing lots of people and things get really messy, that the American government is going to turn on Israel. And it's also our suspicion that Israel is suspicious of this or suspects this, and it's playing its own games with the American government over 9/11, because right at this minute, over the past few days, there's been a lot of movement, let's say, a lot of progress, sudden and surprising progress is being made over the past week or two with the 9/11 truth movement. A lot more scholars are kind of coming on board, and people are appearing on CNN and Fox News. And it's getting, it seems like it's getting kind of scary for the U.S. government, because, you know, there's a lot more heat. And this is in spite of the fact that over the past 5 years, people like us, Signs of the Times, and other alternative websites have been kind of screaming bloody murder and doing everything possible to get even a tiny little bit of coverage and with the mainstream media, and we get nothing. Apart from obviously our Pentagon strike, but that was an aberration.
Damage control.
Yeah, but it was a one off. But so the fact is that the point I'm trying to make is that they it seems that there's a lot of stuff is coming out around on 9/11 that is putting pressure on the U.S. government. That is, you know, probably quite scary for them. And I noticed that actually two new scholars that came on board today who are publishing a book later this year. Yeah, these are two guys that are in associated with Kevin Barrett. One of them is a professor of Jewish studies at the same university, I think, as Kevin Barrett at Wisconsin. So that just piqued my interest, and it kind of made me think about who really has the ability to expose the U.S. government, because it's certainly not the alternative media. But there is, obviously the mainstream media could easily expose the US government and do a lot of damage very quickly. And it seems to be kind of moving in that direction, more so than before, more so than ever before at the minute. And I'm just wondering, it just seems to be coincidental with the whole Israeli aggression and maybe the fact that America might not like some things that Israel is planning to do in the Middle East. But that's all just speculation, as I said, sneaking suspicions, but time will tell.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a culture that's obsessed with watching movies and stuff like that, they can see a classic blackmail plot, you know, unfolding right before their eyes and don't even realize it.
Yes, they're talking about movies. Moving us on to our to the final part of our podcast this week. Jason, our special guest, who has been expressing himself very eloquently over the past half hour, is going to give us a rundown of 10 of the most important movies, in his opinion. And he has a very weighty opinion here in this matter because Jason has watched a lot of movies. These are 10 movies that he believes are extremely important for understanding the world and aspects of human nature, maybe a bit of all and everything, really.
A bit of all and everything.
So,
are these going to be movies that anybody's actually seen?
Anybody who lives in America, certainly, and anybody who came of age in the 90s, definitely.
And for the rest of us, if you've got BitTorrent, you can find them. And
we can't endorse that kind of thing. Go down. No. These movies are all very good movies, and so you should buy them to support the companies and the making of those movies. So I'm going to edumacate the ignorant masters about the wonders of talkies. So I was asked at one point to come up with a list of 5 films that were, you know, essential for understanding human interaction dynamics, the universe, the world, life, whatever you wanna say it as, just sort of like understanding things. So unfortunately, I couldn't pick just 5; I had to pick 10.
Why we only asked for you for 5. If we'd asked you for 10, you would have come back with 20.
Yeah, well, this list was distilled from 20. I had to pick and choose. So the list runs starting from 10 down is Pretty in Pink, number 10, which a lot of people might have a problem with, but very essential.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with that one because I've always loved that movie.
Pretty in Pink, fabulous movie, excellent, unrequited love.
Never seen it.
Number 9 is Don Juan DeMarco, the one with Johnny Depp and Marlon Brando, excellent movie. American Beauty. Number 7 is Election with Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. Number 6 is Beautiful Girls. Natalie Portman's in that one. Number 5 is definitely The Wizard of Oz. Had to be added into the list. Number 4, The Talented Mr. Ripley. Number 3, Donnie Darko. And number 2, The Matrix. And I kind of mixed Matrix and 13th Floor because it came out in the same year and they really had very similar ideas behind them, but they both actually cover two different aspects of what I consider to be esoteric thought. One really, really talks about the meaning of consciousness, the meaning of the soul, and the meaning of free will, whereas The Matrix is mostly really exposing sort of like the hyperdimensional aspects of the world and, you know, controllers and, you know, false reality and agents and all that kind of stuff, which is also included in The 13th Floor. And, of course, at number 1, the movie that everyone has to watch, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Okay.
If only to see Captain Kirk scream, "Khan!"
Yes, that is famous and has been parodied in so many television shows, cartoons.
Okay, well then, going back to Pretty in Pink.
Right.
What is in Pretty in Pink?
Enlighten me. Why do I need to see Pretty in Pink?
Unrequited love. I think it is the best dramatization of the sappy guy in love with the pretty girl who's in love with the, you know, rich guy type thing. Totally, it's basically a story of unrequited love. The character Ducky is in love with Andy, is her name, Andy, who's in love with Blaine. Okay, but these are typical names, by the way, from the 1980s, you know. So it's a really good story, and it had an impact on me, you know, because I'm a sucker for teen films, you know. that was my coming of age time, and you know, they were really popular. So,
so what is it about unrequited love that is it just love that is,
well,
is,
at
is
one
the
point,
essence here?
The character from Babylon 5, Susan Ivanova, comments after Marcus Cole dies that all love is unrequited. And it's,
is this in Pretty in Pink or is this in
Babylon 5? No, that's from Babylon 5. Jesus, Susan.
Well, I thought maybe she was also in Pretty in Pink.
No.
Okay, let's stick with Pretty in Pink here.
Yeah, unrequited love.
Yeah.
Right, yeah,
unrequited
much.
Love. So you're saying that...
So a discussion of dealing with it, because the character Ducky learns to just deal with it and move past it and realize that he's in love with this person who's not in love with him, is never going to love him back, and that it's not really, you know, some sort of untainted love, which we'll get to later when we talk about Don Juan DeMarco, that it wasn't really like an untainted love. He was just – it wasn't really a lust either. It was kind of a love, but he had attached these romantic aspects to it. And so he comes to terms with that, and he deals with it. So it's a good, pretty story. It's, you know – cried at the end when, you know, she gets in.
Okay, so do you hold to the opinion that unrequited love, that all love is unrequited, more or less, in this life?
You know, I think that it's an interesting idea, and I think for some people it is. I think that to help people to deal with the fact that sometimes you're not in the incarnation where you're going to, you know, meet some, you know, if you think polar opposites and soulmates, that you're not ready, you're not prepared, you're not set up to meet them, and you have to learn to get through this life without it, you know, so that in some people's experience, all love is unrequited.
So it's a good lesson there in Pretty in Pink to learn how to deal with that reality. Okay, yeah. Number 9.
Don Juan DeMarco, one of my favorite films. I have this whole Don Juan versus Giacomo Casanova thing, whereas Don Juan is this character, which is, he's really, you know, the smooth pimp daddy, but he's also actually, you know, he's a decent person, whereas Casanova was pretty blatantly, you know, a bastard, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. You know, all of Casanova was more of like a charlatan / impersonator. I mean, he was a con artist. You know, his biography is just loaded with evidence that basically says that he was making it all up. He was more of a pervert, but on a very low level. I mean, he wasn't like at the level of, say, Marquis de Sade was, you know, a level of perversity that is, you know, quite.
That shouldn't be talked about.
It shouldn't be talked about.
And isn't going to be talked about. Go ahead.
Casanova. Casanova is kind of, he's just a manipulator and a psychopath. And, you know, he
Have you seen Fellini's film, Casanova, with Donald Sutherland?
No, I haven't, but I actually probably would like to.
It's extremely depressing because that's exactly the kind of figure it portrays.
He was essentially a charlatan. You know, I mean, he spent the later part of his life, you know, manipulating old women out of their money. Mm-hmm. You know, pretending to be a psychic and stuff.
So, just drawing a link here between number 9 and 10. Obviously, the Don Juan character could be a source of a lot of this unrequited love.
We've
identified the source of the problem.
No.
Okay.
And of course, Don Juan actually does have an experience with unrequited love, because his love, the person he considers to be his soulmate, Donna Ana, you know, he can't be with her because she can't seem to deal with his past experiences. You know, so that's another interesting thing that I thought was very great. And even though, you know, that sort of thing is happening, and even though he tries to commit suicide in the film, he does kind of learn to deal with it and move on, and he does learn to help other people, and he does make some very insightful comments about love. He's just like, you know, where do I have it written down? Oh, yeah, it says, there are only 4 questions of value in life, Don Octavio. What is sacred? Of what is the spirit made? And what is worth living for? And what is worth dying for? The answer to each is the same, only love. So I think that one comment really, really stuck with me for a long time, that it was really sort of kind of an insightful thing to say, that love comprises all those things, you know, is comprised of all those things.
And this is Don Juan said this.
Yeah, this is Don Juan saying.
So he understood this, but he was, he wasn't someone who actually ascribed to...
No. At a certain point in his life, when he came to, he finally found this woman, Donna Ana. It's the one that he wanted to be with, but he couldn't.
Okay.
You know.
All right. Number 8.
American Beauty. Wow, fabulous film. Okay. I kind of had some problems with the last lines of this stuff, you know, when he starts talking about, you know, beauty and all life is beautiful and stuff like that. And from a certain level, sure. From a certain level.
Yeah, like
maybe, you know,
from some other world looking down.
Yeah, all life might be beautiful, but not everything in the world is beautiful. So I didn't agree with that, but I did really like the story of the suburban hell and the character Lester Burnham trying to break out of this suburban hell of his wife, who is blatantly, you know, I don't want to say psychopathic, but she really does have those sort of tendencies of a person who really is, you know, doesn't have these emotions. She's really kind of actually evil, you know. He's breaking away from his wife, who is manipulating and controlling him, you know, and he's trying to live his life the way he would like it. He's trying to make his own choices instead of having someone else make them for him. And of course, you know, he ends up getting shot in the back of the head in the end, but, you know, at least he tried.
Oh, now I don't have to see the movie.
Yeah. Okay. You haven't seen American Beauty?
No.
Yeah. Oh, well. Spoiler for Henry.
Yeah, I actually liked the movie American Beauty quite a bit, and I would tend to agree with, you know, your assessments about, you know, when he talks about, you know, beauty and that whole thing. I mean, you know, yeah, what I found most interesting about it was how it sort of reveals, and not just in American life, but even, you know, in kind of like, you know, America as like a country, and even, you know, in every country, and like on a planetary scale, or like in, you know, from a political perspective, that, you know, there is the image that we would all like to believe, and then there is what is actually true. And so to me, it was sort of a symbolic representation, in addition to being kind of, you know, more literally true. I think, you know, even on a symbolic level, it was kind of interesting how you know, it's everyone works really hard to like maintain this illusion that like everything is okay, when in reality, when you really start digging and looking, you know, it's kind of not so good.
Right. It ties right in back to the Zizou stuff, where we're talking about people who aren't standing up for themselves. And the movie is basically about a person who finally gets to the breaking point. He can't take any more from his wife. He can't take any more from his kid, who is, you know, treating him bad. He can't take any more from his life that is mediocre and unfulfilling. And, you know, he's not doing what he wanted to do. He's not doing what he thinks he should be doing. You know, he's trapped in this job as like a telemarketer, essentially. And so he finally says no. You know, and he does it in some very creative and very humorous ways. And there's a good story behind the whole thing, but it is really about someone, you know, turning around and saying no.
So the message there is strive to get out of mediocrity.
Well, yeah.
But don't get shot in the head.
Well, you know, he does, because that gets him out, doesn't it?
Well, that's a bit depressing.
Well, you know, okay. Life is a depressing. You know, I mean, Dante once said, you know, life is a series of down moments. By the way, Dante from Clerks.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know, life is just a series of down moments.
Which we know that Jason really wanted to put on his list, but
I didn't want to put Clerks. I wanted to put Chasing Amy, but I dropped that one.
Okay.
Because talking about the subject matter would.
So moving on to number 7, then.
Election. Okay, now this movie is the best. It's sort of consider it to be a dramatic documentary of a born psychopath, and how insidiously evil they are in their own way. The character Reese Witherspoon is a high school student of Jim McAllister, who's played by Matthew Broderick, and the young girl is running for class president. And this is directly after she has an affair with one of her teachers, who is the best friend of Jim McAllister, and the teacher gets arrested and all this kind of stuff. And he goes through this horrible thing, and she's trying to manipulate the election, and she's so sure that she is the best person, and he is just convinced that she's evil, and he's looking forward in time to what the world will be like if she becomes like president or something like that. And he's saying, you know, this has got to stop. You know, I can't let this happen. At one point, she says they have this whole little praying montage thing where they come in and she says, "Dear Lord Jesus, I do not often speak with you and ask you for things, but now I really must insist that you help me win the election tomorrow, because I deserve it, and Paul Metzler doesn't. As you well know, I realize that it was your divine hand that disqualified Tammy Metzler, and now I'm asking that you do that one last mile and make sure to put me in office where I belong, so that I may carry out your will on earth as it is in heaven. Amen."
Mm. Yeah, that's just so fitting for considering the entire
George
world
W.
today.
Bush. Yeah, and she really is, the character really is a great study and what I consider a born psychopath, someone who is, mm-hmm. who is messed up.
Genetic,
you know?
Right, no cure for that one.
No, I mean, she's just the pure kind of evil. And just the unemotional, nonchalant way that she ruins, you know, two teachers' careers. You know, even though it was them making bad choices, but she sort of, you know, she like cuts the swath across high school of destroyed people.
Okay.
Number six.
Number six. Beautiful Girls. I actually haven't seen this movie in years and years and years, but I do remember it. One part of it had such a profound effect on me was the interaction between Marty and Willie when they were talking about Winnie the Pooh, and, you know, Christopher Robin created Winnie the Pooh as a figment of his imagination, but as he grew up, he couldn't have it. So Beautiful Girls is really a movie about getting a handle on your life and your emotions and wishful thinking, you know, and self-evaluation, and also the necessity for going back and getting connected with people. The main character, Willie, has to go back to his hometown. You know, he's having this midlife-type crisis thing. He's having these real problems. So he goes back to his town and gets together with his friends, and he's trying to work out all of his problems. So it's a great drama, and there's a lot of pithy quotes in the movie that I thought was really good and interesting discussions. So,
okay.
Number five?
The Wizard of Oz. I think that should Wizard be of Oz. So there's obvious.
There's what I have seen.
Yeah, I don't know if we have to even explain that one, because if you don't know why you have to see that, then...
Yeah.
There's no hope for you.
Yeah, well, The Wizard of Oz.
Well, let's just say there's some very, very direct kind of references to esoteric work in The Wizard of Oz, yeah, dealing with each of the characters and the roles they play.
Right. And I will draw everyone's attention to the similarities between The Wizard of Oz, Star Wars, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because they have the same concept and structure. They have the quartet, the three people, the three individuals that represent, you know, emotional, intellectual, and physical, and then you have the guide type person that leads them down the road to Oz. So I would point that out.
All right, number four.
Number four, The Talented Mr. Ripley. This is probably one of the eeriest films I have seen in a long time, not for any kind of gore or grossness, but just for the character Tom Ripley is just eerie. And I would kind of call him the created psychopath, you know, that he seems to be someone who's been really abused, and he's underclass and very poor, and he's, you know, had this terrible life, and, you know, it turns him kind of like he becomes a sort of a con man type individual, where he's an impersonator and a forger, and He ends up finding a Princeton jacket, and he goes to a party and starts mooching off the rich people, and he makes a friend with this big rich guy whose son is off in Europe, and the rich guy offers to pay him $1,000 to go get his son and bring him back and convince him to come back. So he goes, and he ends up, you know, there's sort of this whole homoerotic undertone with him and the character Dickie Greenleaf, played by Jude Law. And he eventually ends up killing him and assuming his identity and then going about pretending to be him. And then, of course, after a while, he kind of gets found out and people find him out. So he escapes, and then he sort of at the end, he does it again. He starts the whole dynamic over again, you know, with another person. So
that's it has a happy ending.
There's a very happy ending. You know, there's death, gore, destruction. Yeah.
So that's the made psychopath, the created psychopath as a result of societal...
Right.
Pressures, right, or society in general. Yeah, there's a lot of those around today.
Sure, why not? You know, he's the type of person that, of course it's fiction, so I'm just saying that what I saw in it was the idea that a person can either be, you know, bad to the bone, you know, the bad seed type person, you know, which a movie that maybe should have ended up on the list, The Bad Seed, but that a person can either be born that way or they can be made that way. You know, uh-huh, by other psychopaths and et cetera and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So why not?
We're down to number three.
Yeah, we're down to number three. Third one is definitely Donnie Darko. Okay.
Donnie Darko, yeah.
There's a movie that has multiple layers, you know, from time, reincarnation, choice, you know, just the journey from, you know, one level of existence to the next, you know, if you want to talk about one level from one density to the next, you know, graduation, relationships with God, you know, fate, destiny, time loops, however you want to apply it. There's things in the movie that apply to so many different ideas.
All mundane, everyday stuff.
Yeah, like all mundane.
Stuff that happens all the time,
stuff
right?
That happens all the time.
But no one knows it.
Yeah.
Well, you mean people don't talk about this around kitchen tables all over the world?
Of course they do.
I think they do.
All right, Donnie Darko, yeah, that's one to see.
Fantastic movie. Very creepy.
Number two,
The Matrix and 13th Floor. The Matrix should kind of be obvious because it gets talked about all the time.
Okay, so we won't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I wasn't too big of a fan of The Matrix. Too big. I mean, I really liked it for the action scenes, but, you know.
Well, I just thought it was.
He just put that one in there for us.
I put that one in there for you guys.
If you were given the choice, would you take the red pill or the blue pill?
Which one was which? I forgot.
The red pill was. Think about that for a minute and see if you see a link.
The red pill was to know.
It's not making it. I'm not getting it here.
The red pill was to know the truth.
Right.
The blue pill was to go back to reality, illusion.
Well, I mean, I'm sure I would probably not really know unless.
Would
I was
you
in
ask
the
for
situation.
A different color one?
Can I say? Can I take half of both?
Is there another option?
No. I want to sit on the fence.
No, I mean, answering that question, I mean, you know, that's not really a fair question. I mean, because, you know, I could say yes and I could say no and it wouldn't mean anything because I'm not in that situation, you know. Well, you are in that situation every day, but.
Yes. Exactly.
You know, if I was actually there with Lawrence Fishburne, I would probably do whatever he said because he's kind of a beefy guy, you know. Yeah, kind of afraid.
You're like, okay, you're like, I'll take a red pill.
Which one should I take?
Is that related to the free will at all?
Free will, Schmeewill.
There you have
it. He's a star. He's a movie star.
Schmeewill.
Yeah. All right. So,
heard it here first.
Number one,
Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan.
Why is this the number one?
Okay.
Other than for Kirk.
The order is not important, by the way. I mean, they're just ordered.
Well, this is our number one. Come on. Let's lay it on us. What's number one? People should see the number one movie because.
Everyone should see The Wrath of Khan.
Why?
Oh, okay.
What are they going to learn?
What are you going to learn from any movie? You learn what you want to learn. You learn what
you're
open to
learn. Well, you're undercutting here what the whole premise of this podcast is about.
So,
in the final minutes.
Yeah, I'm undercutting the whole thing. It's destroyed. It's destroyed. No. Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan. Great classic tale. I mean, it's pretty much based off of Moby Dick, you know, which is a tale of revenge. And, you know, it really does – I like the fact that it sort of covers the revenge aspect and the whole thing, that it's really kind of a futile pursuit to go after revenge.
Does Captain Kirk end up floating through space on a piece of the Enterprise or something?
No.
Strapped to
– Yeah.
Or does he end up strapped to a Klingon warship or something?
No. Khan dies in the end. Okay. And but you also have the whole factor of dealing with death, and you have the Kirk character's problems with it and his inability to sort of deal and cope with that, and the fact that he sort of gets forced in the situation with Spock, who sacrifices himself, which is, again, you know, an interesting thing. And then there's the core concept about that I really, really liked was the Kobayashi Maru exercise.
What was that?
The no-win situation, the situation in which you cannot win. Which I think is something that a lot of people should think about. You know, being a martial artist is something that I think about quite a bit, is the situation where, you know, there's always going to be the situation where you cannot win, in which you have to, at one point, you know, you will not be able to win and it's over. And that's sort of, you know, a lot of people are very afraid of thinking of that kind of thing. They're very afraid of understanding that life in and of itself is a no-win situation because you cannot get out of life alive. You know,
well, that brings us back to Zinedine Zidane. You put your head down, and you go forward.
Exactly, you know, you go forward, and you don't let it. You don't let. But there's a lot of people that don't let it bother them in the way that they never consider it, and that they're not aware of it. They try to delete it from their awareness, which is a negative thing. Whereas you really should consider the fact, you know.
So would you say that they're facing into this reality of life, essentially being in a no-win situation, that this is a good thing for people to do?
Yes, of course. Why not?
You should face into that. And
well, you should face reality as often as possible.
Yeah,
well, let's try.
Well, then aren't you answering the question about whether you take the red pill or the blue pill?
You're a red piller.
You are.
Well, I mean, you know, you can't get it from that. I mean, I could be making the whole thing up.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
yeah,
we know you're not. I saw you slipping that red pill in there.
Damn
you.
Take
one every day. Yeah. Well, that about wraps up our show for this week, folks. See you later. Bye.
Well, on that, we will end it for this week. Thank you for joining us.
We hope you've enjoyed it.
We do.
Yes, we all hope you have enjoyed the show.
If you'd like to talk about any of the subjects that we've raised in tonight's show, be it joining into the discussion on Zinedine Zidane, talking about the horrendous crimes that Israel is committing and will continue to commit under the banner of the ultimate victimization, or whether it's comments on the films that Jason brought up, or films that maybe you think are films that are important to see to better understand our world, you can come to the Signs of the Times Forum. There is a link from the Signs of the Times page, and the address for Signs of the Times is www.signs-of-the-times.org. So thank you, and we'll see you next week.